From KCUR News, this is Casey Currents reporting news and culture in Kansas City's diverse communities and beyond. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Alex Smith. Sylvia is away this week. On this week's show, a big announcement from Kansas City Public Schools.
So they really jumped up. And as far as I can tell, no other unaccredited school district or provisionally accredited school district made that jump.
The latest on the airport debate.
A lot of people like the way the airport is now.
And Kansas City is now home to a new barbecue tradition.
All the food, everything, utensils, the food itself, even snacks that people bring in have to be certified kosher.
Listen up for Casey Currents just after this hour's news.
I'm Alex Smith.
And I'm Susan Wilson. Casey Currents is KCUR's weekly magazine show. We use voices, stories, and sound to take you to neighborhoods around the region. Getting a 60% on a test usually means a D-, but leaders in the unaccredited Kansas City public schools are hoping it will mean a lot more. That 60% puts them 10 percentage points over what's needed for provisional accreditation. I spoke with KCUR's Maria Carter about what that score means. Maria Carter, welcome to Casey Currents.
Glad to be here.
So does this score mean that the Kansas City School District is regaining accreditation?
No, the State Department of Education wants 3 years of data. But there is some flexibility with issuing accreditation, and Kansas City Superintendent Steve Green is going to go to the Board of Education and the Commissioner of Education and really say that the numbers make a strong case that the district is improving. As of December 2012, they were scoring 19% on these new state standards, and they've gotten that score up to 60%. So that's a big jump, and they're hoping that that number really makes the case that they should get provisional status.
Mainly, the scores have improved in math and science. Is that right?
Yeah, those are the state test scores. The MAP, Missouri Assessment Program scores, have really gone up, and those are the math and science scores. They use those scores in an overall assessment of the school district, and the school district did not get any points for English language arts, but they did see some significant increases in the math and science and social studies as well.
Why is getting reaccredited so important to the district at this point?
Well, it's really important for a lot of reasons. As soon as next spring, though, they could lose thousands of students by students just transferring out of the district. There is a recent Supreme Court ruling that kind of cleared the way for that. And thousands of students, that means potentially millions of dollars for the district in a time when I think they feel like they need every penny they can get to help improve the schools, because the district would be required to pay tuition and transportation costs as well for sending those students to nearby school districts like Lee's Summit or Independence.
What kinds of standards is the state using to judge school districts like KCMO?
Well, the biggest part is academic performance, like we were talking about before, those science and math and English and social studies standards. And also part of it is, are students improving on that? It's not just we need students, 80% of students, to be proficient. It looks at last year and makes sure you're getting a little higher on that, and those numbers are going up. They also look at subgroups, minorities, English as a second language speakers, students with disabilities, and to make sure that the gap is not too wide and that the gap is narrowing between those groups and the whole student population. But then they also look at a broad range of things, attendance rates, graduation rates, and just making sure students are prepared to go to college or right into the workforce afterwards.
So how did Kansas City, Missouri School District improve in some of the areas that they've made gains?
Superintendent Steve Green says it's a laser-like focus, that they have just really focused on their academics and, you know, that they've cut out some of the programs that weren't working. It sounds a little bit to me like, you know, once you know the standards, it's easier to ace the test so that they were, you know, they knew what they needed to work on. And so those are the areas that they worked on. Clearly, they would have liked to have done better in some areas like English.
Am I to assume that they didn't make gains in things like graduation rates? I know that's an issue that they've had for a long time.
I don't know about those specific numbers. They, you know, they did get attendance up. They've got a lot of their academics up. They seem to... and I haven't gone in depth with their numbers. It's a complicated formula, but they seem confident that they are making strides in graduation rates and attendance. You know, they say half the problem is you got to get students into where they're supposed to be so they can learn those academics that they need to know.
So how have the results that KCMO achieved compared to the other districts that have also been trying to regain their accreditation, like St. Louis, for example?
Yeah, well, Kansas City was by far the star of the bunch. St. Louis, they regained provisional status last year. These are new standards. St. Louis got 25%. So Kansas City went from having 19% to, you know, getting 60% of the points possible. So they really jumped up. And I, as far as I can tell, no other unaccredited school district or provisionally accredited school district made that jump. Now, they'll say they were the lowest down. They had 19%, which was the lowest in the state. So they could make those big jumps. But I'm sure some other school districts will be looking to them and how they did it.
So what's next for Kansas City, Missouri schools? What do they plan on really focusing on in the next year?
One area they are definitely going to be working on is English and language arts and hopefully getting some points on those. They're pretty confident that they can do that. And, you know, I was walking around Paseo. I did stop in an English classroom, but I also stopped in an arts classroom. And the focus is on all these subjects. At least there was a big cross-disciplinary focus speaking with the teachers. The English teacher said, well, we may have, you know, students bring in history assignments, and I work on, you know, their history papers with them or incorporating that into an essay, and it goes both ways, that there's more writing in some of the other classes.
So is there a specific plan, though, in terms of strategies that they'll use to really try to work on this English and language arts area?
I personally don't know of the specific plans, you know, on a school level. I'm sure that those vary based on the academic level and individual schools. One of the things they did talk about, and I spoke with someone from the Department of Elementary and Secondary Education about, was that, and he was saying Kansas City was really looking at the data, but also at, you know, individual student data and what individual students need to work on. So I think, you know, they're probably digging down deep and saying, hello, student, you know, we need you to improve on English. These are the areas that we're focusing on. This is what this class needs to focus on, and trying to get more people in line with those state test standards.
Maria Carter, thanks for being with us on KC Currents.
Glad to be here.
Kansas City is all abuzz about the future of its 40-year-old airport. Supporters of a proposal for a new one-terminal facility say that lower operating costs, better security, and more restaurant and shopping options are worth the $1 billion price tag. But fans of the current three-terminal system say that convenience will be sacrificed. After all, KCI scored high marks in a recent J.D. Power & Associates survey that measured convenience factors such as access to check-in and baggage claim. Susan ventured out to KCI, where she heard travelers' opinions flying.
My name's Marty Wilson from Atlanta, Georgia. Very nice airport, easy to get around in, easy to find my way, my first time here. So I found my way to where I was going, and I'm on my way back home now.
I'm Robin, and I'm from Overland Park. I've not been unhappy with the airport. I've traveled all over the country, been in lots of airports, and this is my very favorite. I love being able to go to the gate, or all close to the gate, and see people come off the airline, and that doesn't happen anywhere else.
I'm Clark Lees. I'm from Olathe, Kansas. I think it's the most convenient, don't you? Most convenient airport I've ever. I'm not that I'm a world traveler, but it's wonderful. Yeah, I just think it's wonderful. The in and out, you know, ability. Yeah, I'm very pleased.
I'm Pauline Green. I'm from Kansas City, Missouri. I think they should leave it as is, because of the easy access. And why spend the money on, you know, another terminal when it is so easy? Just make the repairs they need to repair.
Well, there may be people a lot smarter than me that know there's a better plan, and I'm totally on board with that too, but I've liked it the way it is.
Ellen Lavin from Overland Park, Kansas. I like it the way it is. I think it's very navigable, and I don't see any reason to change it.
Recently, the 24-member panel appointed by Mayor Sly James began its work of sorting through the ideas and issues. And at a recent town hall meeting, Congressman Sam Graves came out against a plan for a new terminal. Susan talked with Kansas City Star reporter Dave Helling, who's been writing about the issue. He explained that despite the heated public debate, a new airport is probably at least 8 years away, and only a few of those debating the issue will actually be involved in the final decision.
By and large, the only voice citizens will have of Kansas City is if and when this goes to a vote of the people. That's possible. My guess is if it happens, it would be 2014, maybe in November, which is a big election time. If it does go to a vote of the people, it would just be Kansas City, Missouri residents. It would not be people from Johnson County or Wyandotte County or other communities that use the airport but don't live in Kansas City, Missouri. And that will cause some concern because a lot of airport users will have virtually no say at all, at least officially, in how the airport goes forward.
So I know one option that the special committee is considering is this one terminal idea, which is going to be a $1.2 billion project, as I saw that the other day. Why is this option a possible attractive option?
The people who support the single terminal, new single terminal idea, say that the airport is about half a century old, that there are certain things that have to be done environmentally, baggage, handling, plumbing, that type of thing that you're going to have to do anyway. And so as long as you're undergoing those changes, Susan, they say you might as well build a new, convenient, secure, friendly new terminal. That means more shops, more restaurants, better security screening systems, that this is the time to do it. Because if you do, if you say you did only $400 or $500 million worth of repairs, they say, well, look, you'll just have to come back in 10 years and do it again. So in essence, the argument they're making is, again, this is from supporters of the idea. The argument they make is that this airport has reached the end of its useful life. It isn't going to get any cheaper to build a new terminal. So let's build something that's modern and convenient for the traveling public.
Now, the average citizen who comes in the airport, looks at the three terminals, says that they're very convenient. They seem to have the opinion of, oh, a few renovations, and all of this could be figured out with the existing configuration. Not so, though, according to people who've looked at the infrastructure and what's underneath the airport, right?
There are certain repairs that need to be made that will be quite expensive. And I think even opponents of the single terminal say, we understand there will have to be some improvements. So the question is whether you stop there or go ahead and rebuild a new modern facility. And I think a lot of people who have used the airport for years are worried that if you did that, if you went to a single modern terminal, that you would lose some of the convenience, which is undoubtedly a feature of Kansas City International today. I mean, it was built as a very convenient airport. You don't have a long way to walk. Now, keep in mind, one of the reasons it's so convenient is because of the way it's configured now. Security screening takes place at different gates. And, of course, that's convenient because you have a lot more screeners than you have at most airports.
But also more costly, some say.
And that's the point, that it's much more costly. And, frankly, you can talk to people who work with or for airlines who pay a lot of that cost, who say that Kansas City International may be very inconvenient, but it's also, costs more than would have to otherwise. And so one of the, again, the arguments for a new terminal is we could cut down on the number of screeners, we could have fewer screening points, and that convenience factor, it would become more inconvenient, but perhaps less costly.
Fewer shuttles too, right?
Right. One of the problems now at KCI is if you have to change airlines and you're in Terminal B and your connecting airline is in Terminal C, you have to hop on a shuttle and go around. There's no way to easy way to get from, you know, B to C or A to B to C. So that would be solved. But again, at the price of perhaps longer lines, a longer traveling distance from where you park your car to get to your airline. So that's the kind of thing that Kansas City is discussing. We'll have to work out in the months ahead.
You recently attended a town hall meeting that was bipartisan, and there was a lot of discussion about this. What were the takeaways from this town hall meeting?
Well, a couple of things. There were Republicans and Democrats, but it was basically set up for opponents of the single terminal idea. Sam Graves, the congressman from north of the river, is very much against the big single terminal idea. And so we sort of had a bunch of witnesses to talk about that. So the takeaway was that there is very vocal opposition to a single terminal. A lot of people like the way the airport is now. But the other thing I think I heard is that there is a sense that our choices don't have to be either do nothing or do $1.2 billion. You're beginning to see that there is some discussion that maybe there is a place to meet in the middle, to do it more cheaply, to keep as many of the convenience items out at the airport as we can, and yet at the same time, correct some of the problems that I think everyone agrees there is. So that was my takeaway, that maybe there's compromise possible on this issue.
Now, as you heard about a potential compromise and maybe middle ground there, what would that actually look like?
Well, I'm not an airport designer, so, you know, the specifics are yet to be determined. I do think that one possible path would be to keep, say, two of the terminals, to centralize your security so that you don't have security at each gate. You might have people movers so that you connect the two terminals more easily. Use one of the existing terminals then for restaurants and shops. I mean, there are all kinds of different ways to approach the concerns without, in essence, removing all three terminals and building a single terminal, which is, again, what supporters suggest. But that's just one answer. I mean, you know, there's a way to do a single terminal but keep the horseshoe configuration. We're years away from design, but you do get the sense conceptually that both sides understand that there can be a middle ground between doing nothing and doing everything.
One big bone of contention is this $1.2 billion price tag, and opponents say we have better uses for the money. How does this $1.2 billion price tag stack up against other similar airport projects? Is it ultra expensive, as some of the opponents think that it is?
Well, doing a major terminal overhaul can be quite expensive. The Philadelphia project, which I'm taking a look at, for example, is about $5 billion. Now, Philadelphia is a much bigger airport than ours and has more traffic. We should be clear that the $1.2 billion cost, which was sort of the fixed cost estimate at the airport, would not involve, at least as it's now contemplated, general taxpayer dollars. It would be paid for potentially by added fees for the airlines, higher ticket prices, higher parking costs at the airport, perhaps some taxes added on to the food and drink you buy out there. Federal money might be involved, potentially state money, although that's a very long shot. So the exact financing mechanism hasn't been put together. In general, airport projects are not funded by general taxpayer dollars. They're paid for by users, which is one reason why they tend to be more popular with politicians than building a new school or building a new downtown arena, because you don't necessarily impact people who don't use the airport. So the cost figure of $1.2 billion seems about right, based on what other projects have been costing. And the mechanism is still under great discussion by the people who are studying this. We just don't know. We'll see.
So travelers beware. They'll be paying, actually, for the new airport improvements.
Yes, A. And B, that's why it's so important that you have the airlines on board, too, because they have to pay a part of the cost. You know, they pay, for example, now to rent the gates where they operate out of, and those gate rental fees would almost certainly go up if they build a new terminal or anything like it. And so the airlines are already in discussions with the aviation department and others trying to hold down those costs to make sure that they don't have to spend a lot of money to do something they don't want to see done either. So as I suggested earlier, airlines, ticket holders, workers out there, city council people, they're all stakeholders in this discussion. Why? There are a lot of moving parts.
How does the Federal Aviation Administration weigh in to this whole issue?
Well, the FAA has what's called the Airport Improvement Program, which is money that's set aside for improvement projects across the country. And I think in the current budget, it's proposed to be about $3.35 billion. But that's for the entire United States. And frankly, one of the directions from Congress is to try and get more of that money to smaller airports and stay away from big projects like Kansas City. And as a matter of fact, even the aviation officials here have said that they're not confident they'll get a lot of money from the federal government or the FAA to actually build this project, which means that the financing is a little more complicated. In addition to that, though, the FAA has a regulatory oversight function in which it'll take a look at the plan itself, its environmental impact, its impact on safety, passenger convenience, that type of thing. And so they'll have some sort of process to go through as well as the design, again, assuming this goes forward, as the design is put together, they have some input into what the project will look like.
Now, in terms of the political angles here, Representative Graves is an opponent. How much do you expect him to be a thorn in the side of any of the political machinations that go on to make this happen? And are there similar proponents on the other side of the aisle?
It is unusual for a local member of Congress to oppose an airport project. And these other projects that I've talked about, again, Atlanta, Philadelphia, Wichita, other places, members of Congress are typically pretty supportive. And so it's unusual for a member to be against it. And so that will be significant because not only in terms of funding and the FAA's role, but if there is a vocal group opposed to a single terminal at KCI and they have a champion in the local congressman, it just raises the bar higher for people who may want to put this on the ballot. As a public matter, to have a congressman against you is not a good thing if you support this. So that'll be important. So far, other members of Congress have taken a bit of a back seat to Sam. I mean, you haven't heard Congressman Cleaver, for example, champion this idea. That may change as we go forward. I think right now Sam Graves is the leading politician on the federal level involved in this debate, and his opposition to the broad plan is something that's obviously of interest and concern to the supporters of a new airport.
Dave Helling, thank you for being with us on KC Currents.
My pleasure.
The KCI Advisory Board has begun the process of setting priorities for its work. The board recently toured the airport and reviewed a list of needed airport improvements. We'll keep you updated as the debate continues. Coming up, getting to know Kansas City's Black Israelites. This is KC Currents.
This is KC Currents. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Alex Smith. Blacks and Jews have historically had a complicated relationship in the United States, maybe most of all when they claim the same religion or historical ancestry. The development of the Black Israelite or Black Jewish faith has its roots in Kansas, according to a book published earlier this year by a University of Kansas professor.
This interpretation of the biblical roots of Africans has spread far, from New York to South Africa and back to Israel, and it sparked no shortage of controversy. Some Black Israelite groups have even been hate groups. We'll hear from the author of the book in a few minutes, but first, a local man tells us how he became interested in Judaism.
My birth name is Brian Michael Long, so my mother named me. As a part of my conversion, I am now known as Mikhail Korban Ben Avraham Vassara.
How did you first get involved in the Hebrew Israelite religion?
Interesting journey. It started in college, just doing a lot of self-searching. Had gone through some vicious cycles of a typical student athlete life, and just felt myself empty. I was raised a Christian of the Disciples of Christ denomination. So initially I identified as a Christian, but just through research, study, and just a big journey, I guess you could say, I came to understand through understanding history and both prophecy that African-Americans have Hebrew heritage. And so that just led me to really start to inquire more into that background. I've come to understand it's more of a cultural heritage as opposed to a religion. And so I think to really get that understood, we have a cultural heritage of an Israelite identity as opposed to really a religious identity, because it just it infuses every aspect of our life to understand of yourself as an Israelite.
What do you think especially appealed to you about the whole Hebrew Israelite story, theology, mm-hmm. etc.?
One, it provides an answer to a big question about our identity as African Americans. You know, that being stripped from us through our enslavement, it really provided an answer and a concrete identity that, you know, not only we can ethnically embrace, but we can also nationally embrace. Because, I mean, if you just look at history as a nation, America had never really embraced us as a people historically, even presently. It provided a cultural refuge. And then it provided also a greater context to understand the scriptures. As a Christian, there were a lot of gaps that I know I had from just understanding things from a Western Christian standpoint. But as I got more into the cultural identity of being an Israelite, it makes the scriptures that much more clear. And even having an idiomatic understanding.
So I have to ask you, do you feel like you're often understood by others because of your religious preference?
My experience is really not so much. I mean, people know that, you know, I have some different views, but I don't think they really, here comes, you know, DeVar or Michael, the black Jew. It's not so much like that. No, I mean, at one point in time, I think I did wear it more on my sleeve, but as I've matured and, you know, kind of grown into it, it's something that, you know, people just notice and inquire more so. But they don't really just, oh, here he comes, a black. No, it's not like that.
So you didn't have to explain your religious choice to, let's say, friends or family who might have been a part of more traditional.
Mm-hmm. Initially. I mean, it was an initial probably time it was like that, yeah, where they were like, so what are you doing? You know, because there are major differences in Israelite culture, of course. We recognize the Sabbath, you know, Friday night to Saturday night. We keep all the scriptural holy days. Our diets are different. So there were some things initially that people questioned, you know. And so providing a response and really even showing them in the scripture where this is what it says, you know, we should be doing. So there were some questions initially, but, you know, it's become more, I guess, accepted.
What does the Hebrew Israelite movement look like in Kansas City? Is there a church, for example?
Mm-hmm. There's several camps in Kansas City. We are pretty much called camps. At least I'm thinking in the greater Kansas City area, there's about 100 at least I can think of individuals who identify as such. There probably is more. There's about probably 6 or 7 camps in Kansas City. And I think one of the ideas people have of Israelites is the New York on the corner hollering and, you know, just insulting people and kind of shoving it down your throat. You know, they're dressed up in the ancient attire more so. But that's not all Kansas City. Kansas City has everything from people who, you know, are just, you know, everyday 9-to-5 people to those who are more on the corner and preaching, you know, with some more fire and brimstone kind of sermon, I guess you could say.
Now, to what extent do the camps in Kansas City adhere to like black nationalist kinds of ideologies?
I would assume that it pretty much has a strong influence in most of the camps, not to the point of being of supremacist thought, you know, more indigenous thought, like we are the original, mm-hmm. more so as opposed to like we are the supreme people. I mean, you know, but I do believe there is an influence of black nationalism, which has to be understood in the context of do for self and self-determination more so as opposed to like a supremacist thought. I do believe there's an FBI report that has a black Hebrew Israelites as one of the extremist groups to be, you know, on the lookout for. But that's not the case for all Israelites. There may be some who are more extreme in their views. Kansas City, to my knowledge, does not have any extremist activity to that degree.
You know, I was going to ask you about that because the Southern Poverty Law Center does identify certain black Israelite groups as black supremacists, mm-hmm. hate groups, mm-hmm. Anti-gay. What do you think about that?
My thoughts are like, you know, each group is going to have its own character, and it's pretty much made up based on the experiences of the individuals who come together. I'm not one who condones extremist activity personally. I'm a man of peace. You know, I look at the scriptures and the prophets and their principled stance. They weren't compromising, but at the same time, they weren't condemning to the point where, you know, it's, you know, we're going to take you out. So I don't agree with that whatsoever. I mean, it's really anything that deals with hate. It's not scriptural, you know, to the point where we can come together and break bread and fellowship and reason, the important word reason, to, you know, come to some understandings and prayerfully lead someone, if they are out of line, to repentance. So, yeah, I think the extremist notions are ridiculous.
So where does your camp worship?
We had a small group that would come together at, you know, people's houses. As we've matured, we have more gravitated to synagogues. For instance, I'm a member of Ohev Shalom Synagogue on 75th and Null. I'm actually on the board there as well. And, you know, we're really striving to just be recognized as Black Jews. Interestingly, a lot of the people that I once fellowship with have made what's called Aliyah. They've gone home to Israel.
So you actually worship in a traditional Jewish synagogue.
Yes, indeed.
Now, how are Black Israelites received by, let's say, Jewish people of European descent mm-hmm. in the local synagogues?
I have had mostly good experiences. Early on, I had kind of a interesting, I guess, dialogue with someone where they asked if I was Jewish, but the way it was said was kind of, "You're not Jewish, are you?" I'm like, at the time, I didn't really have an understanding, so I was like, I was really, you know, on a search. So that kind of rubbed me in a interesting way, I guess you could say. But the synagogue I attend, there's several African-American families that attend the synagogue, and we're not treated with any difference whatsoever. They may kind of confuse us sometimes, you know.
In what way?
I mean, you know, one brother I fellowship with, he comes to the synagogue with me. We may kind of resemble each other. We both have full beards, short hair, about the same complected. So they may call me his name sometimes and, you know, call him my name. So, but other than that, I mean, it's all love, you know. It's an embracing, warm environment. And that's why I really have settled at Ohev Shalom and have great respect for the rabbi there. And there's also a chaplain rabbi there that, I mean, have received us with open arms, you know, and even the congregation itself has received us with open arms.
That was Michael DeVar Long. To hear more about the development of Black Israelite sects in the United States, we now turn to History and American Studies professor Jacob Dorman, the author of The Chosen People, The Rise of Black Israelite Religions. What interested you in Black Israelites particularly?
I was very interested in Black nationalism and Jewish nationalism, or Zionism. I was interested in that comparison and in their similarities. And so Black Jews were a topic that allowed me to really explore both of those things. And I think that they challenge both Jewish identity, but also they have a lot to teach us, I think, about Black identity and the process of forming new religions and new cultures in the Americas in general. So it's just been an endlessly fascinating topic for me.
I noticed from reading the book that there's some variation in the words people use to describe Black Israelite movements or religions. So when you use the term Black Israelite, what does this mean to you?
Well, Black Israelite, and the way I'm using it is really the way people in the communities have used it over the last century. Black Israelites identify with the ancient Israelites. They believe that the ancient Israelites were Black and that contemporary Black people are their descendants. Oftentimes that means believing that Jesus was Black. So Israelite does not necessarily denote a specific religion, but among Black Israelites, you might have Black Jews, you might have Christians, you might have Rastafarians, even Black Muslims. Many Black Muslims would share the basic tenets of the beliefs of Black Israelites. My focus in the book is on Black Jews who are practicing variants of Judaism, but there's other religions. Most Black Israelites today are Christians, and that's probably true 100 years ago as well.
Can you explain the customs of Black Israelites, how they worship?
There's a huge range. Some of the groups practice forms of Judaism today that are very similar to the forms of Judaism practiced in Sephardic or Ashkenazi synagogues of European derivation. They practice all the same festivals. They practice the same high holidays. They would read from the Torah on Shabbat. They would follow kashrut, or they would keep the laws of the dietary laws. Then there's other groups like the Church of God and Saints of Christ, which started actually in Lawrence, Kansas in 1896. And they also follow many of the same festivals, but they have their own liturgy, which is quite unique and really quite beautiful. So there's many different forms of Judaism that are quite robust and that have changed as well over the last century. But you could say the same thing about Ashkenazi or Sephardic Judaism of today is, you know, quite different than it was as it was practiced 150 years ago in Eastern Europe. So religions are always changing and evolving. And, you know, I would love it if more Jews of European descent actually visited and came to appreciate some of these forms of Judaism created by Black Israelites, because they're really quite exceptional and quite beautiful.
Now, you mentioned Lawrence. I imagine people might be surprised to know that Kansas played a role in this whole story about Black Israelites. Now, you write that Kansas was viewed as a kind of a promised land for Blacks after emancipation. What was it about Kansas at that time that made it a place where Black Israelites flourished and the movement was kind of born?
Northeast Kansas, as many listeners know, was one of the centers of African-American life during and after the Civil War, partly because of its legacy as a free state and the place where John Brown fought. It acquired a reputation, almost a saintly reputation, in the minds of many African-Americans because of that conflict of the 1850s. And then in the 1870s, Kansas, as its population boomed and it attracted immigrants from all over the world, it also attracted African-Americans who came to farm and find independence. And so Northeast Kansas actually had two of the only cities in the country that had a Black percentage that was over 20% in Atchison and Topeka. So it was a major center of Black population. Lawrence was around 20% as well, African-American. It was also on the Santa Fe Railroad line, and it was there that Prophet William Saunders Crowdy decided to start preaching his message.
Now, you mentioned Prophet Crowdy. Some reports back then, you write, said that he acted strangely. He was hearing voices. Was he a prophet or a madman?
That's probably an eternal question for people that have a direct line to God. But he, you know, was able to attract thousands of followers. So he certainly wasn't treated as a madman by his contemporaries. But there is a line that no one's a prophet in their own hometown. I think his wife was certainly a little bit displeased when this religious phase started to express itself. But he, you know, was able to convince even very hostile audiences that he was speaking the truth and that he was divinely blessed and gifted. And he was really a tremendous evangelist. He showed up in New York City in within months had 2,000 followers and repeated the same thing in Philadelphia. So he really was quite effective and helped to transform the American religious landscape because he was preaching a form of holiness, Christianity, but he was able to create thousands of followers who believed that, as he did, that the ancient Israelites were black and that contemporary blacks had kind of a direct line to that inheritance. And he was doing this in a time when, you know, there was lynching and Jim Crow discrimination across the country. So his message really found open ears.
And that's how he was able to spread the movement to the bigger cities of the Northeast. And there was even a South African connection.
That's right. There was a West Indian-born missionary named Albert Christian who was working with the AME Church, the African Methodist Episcopal Church, which is the first independent black denomination. And Christian came to Philadelphia, and according to the story spread by the Church of God and the Saints of Christ, Crowdy's church, Christian found Bishop Crowdy and recognized him immediately as a person he had actually seen in a dream, and he accepted the teachings, and he spread them to South Africa when he returned there in 1903. And so one of the really amazing things about this story is that the Crowdy's church, which started here in Lawrence, Kansas, spread to South Africa in 1903, and it's been a transnational African-American directed church for over 100 years. So this teaching, the Israelite teaching, spread into South Africa, and it spread to other churches, and it helped to inspire other African-initiated churches. It taught people that, in this case, in South Africa, people that were being occupied and colonized, or in the States, African-Americans, people that were being Jim Crowed and segregated and in extreme cases, lynched and quite commonly disenfranchised. It taught people in both cases that they, in actuality, had a glorious past as the people of the book, the chosen people, people directly descended from the ancient Israelites, and it helped to really transform the consciousness of African and African-American people.
I'm Susan Wilson, and you're listening to KC Currents. We're talking with KU American Studies professor Jacob Dorman about his book, The Chosen People, The Rise of Black Israelite Religions. The Black Israelite movement drew criticism from both African-American Christians and Eastern European Jews. Why the criticism?
Jews of European descent had quite an embattled relationship with Black Israelites or Black Jews, as some of them became, that probably lasted from the 20s really into the present and to some extent. And they clashed over many things. One was just over the question of who was a Jew. They tended to get into these kinds of arguments. Black Jewish leaders of the 1920s who started to form synagogues as opposed to churches, they started to form more Judaic forms of Black Israelitism during the Harlem Renaissance. And they tended to preach that they were the true Jews and that white Jews were imposters, that the white Jews were descended from Esau or from Edom, rather, that they were Edomites and not true Jews and not legitimate. Most white Jews probably saw the black Jews as illegitimate as well. And there are some exceptions to that. There were several efforts in the during the civil rights movement to try to bring these two communities closer together, but neither group really wanted to validate the other group, and that's only starting to change really in the last decade.
Black Israelite sects believed, as you said, that Africans were severed from Jewish religion during the Roman age, and they might have been part of the lost tribes of Israel, etc. Is there any evidence of this?
Well, they would say yes. There's quite a lot of evidence, and they would look at a mix of sort of textual evidence from the Bible, I am black and comely, in the Song of Songs and many other passages of scriptures, to say that the ancient Israelites were people of color. And then there's, in the 20th century, there's been a stream of kind of amateur anthropologists who point to ethnographic cultural data to say that contemporary West African peoples are descended from ancient Israelites. And I guess most recently there's been a number of scholars that have looked at African historical, contemporary kind of African historical sources to point to what they claim are Israelite and Assyrian origins for many African peoples. My position is I haven't attempted to take a position on those beliefs. And in my reading, these are religious beliefs, and it would be kind of as inappropriate for me to try to prove or disprove them as it would be for me to try to prove or disprove the resurrection or any of the kind of sacred beliefs of any other religion. I will say that I don't think that there's solid historical proof that most secular historians would accept. But you could say the same thing of the alleged links between, you know, my Eastern European ancestors and the Israelites. So I think the really interesting thing is how people, all people, not simply black Israelites, but how all people create stories and narratives to try to explain their past and to link themselves to a historied sense of.
So what's the Black Israelite movement like today?
Well, it's changed a lot, and it's constantly changing. There's basically three waves of Black Israelite movements. The first would be the movement of the holiness churches of the 1890s and the early 1900s. And this is the Prophet Crowdy, Bishop Christian, and there's many other leaders and many other holiness churches that incorporated those Israelite ideas. And then in the 1920s, the period of the Harlem Renaissance, you have the rise of Judaic forms of Black Israelite churches that adopt Judaism. And then in the 60s, in the Civil Rights era, you have the rise of a third wave of Black nationalist Black Israelite groups. And these are the groups that are most famous for their various cable TV shows or for their public preaching on the streets of New York and whatnot. A lot of these movements tend to be quite masculinist, quite patriarchal, to have very strong, sometimes even violent rhetoric, to emphasize immigrationism or migration or colonization.
I want to ask you that some sects of Black Israelite congregations today have been labeled Black supremacist or hate groups by the Southern Poverty Law Center. Is this fair? Are they misunderstood?
Well, you know, there's so many different groups that you really would have to take, I think, a case-by-case example. The largest of these groups is probably the original African Hebrew Israelite nation that moved from Chicago to Dimona, Israel in 1969. And their rhetoric when they first came to Israel was quite divisive. They said, this is our land, not your land. They promised to push the the white Jews into the sea. Literally, they said things like that. But then that rhetoric very quickly changed, and they started to seek ways to accommodate themselves and to live in peace with their neighbors, and they've succeeded at that.
How about the sex in America now, the Black Israelite sex in America right now?
The biggest organization is probably the Church of God and Saints of Christ, which was the biggest one in 1903. I mean, it's the one that started in Lawrence, Kansas in 1896. And I think in, say, the last decade, I think there's been kind of a maturation. I think from both sides, from white Jews and from Black Jews, you hear less divisive rhetoric. Michelle Obama's cousin, Rabbi Capers Funye, leads a congregation on the south side of Chicago and has actually been accepted into the Chicago Board of Rabbis. So he is somebody who is kind of accepted by everybody, by Black Jews, by white Jews. There's more and more, there's African Americans who have multi-generational histories of practicing Judaism, who are becoming part of majority white communities and schools, including in the Kansas City area. So there's a kind of process that happens, I think, over generations. And I think the Jewish community as a whole is becoming much more diverse through the incorporation of Israelite groups, through conversion and through adoption. And I think there's a real interest among many more progressive Jews in moving beyond a racialist definition of Judaism and accepting people and welcoming people of color.
Jake Dorman, thank you for joining us today on KC Currents.
Well, thank you so much, Susan. I really appreciate your interest. It's great to be here.
Jacob Dorman is a professor of history and American studies at the University of Kansas. His book is called The Chosen People, The Rise of Black Israelite Religions.
Get up in the morning, slaving for bread, sir, so that every mouth can be fed.
After the break, we catch up with a more traditional Jewish community in Kansas. This is KC Currents. This is KC Currents. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Alex Smith, filling in for Sylvia Maria Gross.
Kansas City barbecue has legions of fans both locally and around the country, thanks to a unique style that dates back to the 1920s. But some local barbecue lovers are working to link that culinary tradition to one with even deeper roots. Last Sunday afternoon, the second annual Kansas City Kosher Barbecue Contest took place in the parking lot of the B'nai Yehuda Synagogue in suburban Overland Park. The event drew a couple of thousand participants and teams from New York, Chicago, and St. Louis. Among the judges was Simon Majumdar from the Next Iron Chef on the Food Network. Alex Smith was there and met some of the participants.
Zev Nierenberg from New York.
Avi Schreiman, also from New York.
Our team name is Meat and Honey.
My name is Frank Mueller. Our team name is Cholesterol Smolesterol.
My name is Michael Dollywall. I'm from Highland Park, Illinois. And we're part of Team Farbring It.
I'm Chris Jones from Northern California.
What brought me out? Is that really a question? This is the barbecue capital of the world. There's nothing to talk about.
Kosher meat, of course, is to the Jewish dietary guidelines. Obviously, there's no pork. The animal has to be butchered a certain way. There can't be any blood in the animal.
Kansas City, it's a little difficult.
There's no kosher restaurants here.
There's no full-time kosher restaurant. We've got Penthouse in Leawood has a kosher deli in the back, and they have a kosher bakery.
Many of our families who observe kashrut, or kosher eating, actually make our own food at home from scratch.
Having this competition gives them one time a year
which is like the best day of the year for them ever because they get to come in and have amazing barbecue.
We got here after Shabbat last night, so about sundown.
We've been out here smoking since about 9:45 last night.
I've been up since 8 o'clock yesterday morning.
And we drank all night, and we got to this point, and it's 2 p.m. right now, the next day. It's been a long day.
We are ready for the adult pickle eating contest.
In kosher barbecue, all the food, everything, utensils, the food itself, even snacks that people bring in have to be certified kosher. So in this situation, instead of you bringing your own food in, your own beef, it is all supplied for you.
Everyone has the same smoker. Everyone's got the same choice of ingredients.
Everyone's on an even playing field. They're all kind of using the same stuff, and they've got to really, their methods and their recipes have to shine.
It is the first to finish two pickles. And these aren't small pickles, people.
I have actually not had non-kosher barbecue before. So I can't really give you a straight-up comparison between the two.
Never had non-kosher barbecue.
I've never had non-kosher barbecue before.
I have not, no.
I have had non-kosher barbecue.
It's actually, it's pretty exciting. The difference is that with the kosher meat, they salt everything.
The meat is salted and rinsed a number of times to remove all the blood before it's cooked.
So I'm not used to that.
Whereas a lot of traditional barbecue, they'd be using very salted rubs to try and intensify flavor. That's already been done in the slaughtering process for kosher food.
It turns out you do a lot more sugar than you would normally, because normally you would do a 50-50 mix of sugar, salt. Kosher barbecue, you do a lot more sugar, a lot other seasonings.
I'm really happy with my ribs and my chicken, and we'll see what they think about my brisket.
It came out very good. Our turkey was excellent. Our brisket was a little chewy, but I think everything else was really, really good.
We didn't know we were doing it all, so we just we added water and stuff. We did what everyone else was doing.
The overall Kansas City Bod Kosher Barbecue 2013, the grand champion is Full House Barbecue!
Well, my name's Simon Majumder.
We have a celebrity judge, which is really incredible.
And I guess how most people know me as the mean English judge on Iron Chef and the next Iron Chef. And I'm thrilled that so many people came and got to experience it and see something new and a different side of the Jewish community. I certainly did. I saw a whole new angle that I didn't know about. I come to Kansas City every year to cook at the American Royal, but now I'm probably going to come twice a year so I can be at the Kosher Barbecue Festival as well.
We appreciate you tuning in to Casey Currents. This show will be archived, along with all of our past shows, on the Casey Currents page at kcur.org.
You can also hear individual stories there, or sign up for our podcast, or find us on iTunes. Contact us at kcurrents@kcur.org or on Twitter at Casey Currents.
Casey Currents is produced by Sylvia Maria Gross. Alex Smith is our associate producer, and our intern is Monica Sandretsky. Our theme music is by Approach, and as always, I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Alex Smith. Sylvia will be back next week.